Anna, thank you for inviting me into your studio.
I'm thrilled to have you here, Will.
I'm really excited to talk to you about Easy Wins. Here is the book.
Yep, there it is.
For those who haven't seen it before. There are lots of cookbooks out there, and in fact, when I flick through them, I can get very excited about food, but very seldom do I flick through a book and want to cook absolutely everything in it, but also think I could. Because when I look at the recipes are simple, the method is relatively simple on most of them, and so it feels very manageable. Tell me a bit about the philosophy behind the book.
Well, yeah, it's... thank you for saying that.
That's a pleasure.
That's really, really kind and means an enormous amount because it's still quite fresh, this.
Yeah.
You know, and it feels like a little book baby and it feels a bit scary for it to be out in the world. So all encouragement is feels very bolstering and lovely. So Easy Wins, really, for me, I wanted recipes to be about those moments where you spend just about the right amount of time in the kitchen. Mm. So long enough for it to feel like, you know, you've managed to do some chopping and have that moment, but not so long that, you know, it's taking over your life. And I wanted it to be that moment where you take the food to the table, you feel like you've done something great, everyone around the table laps it up, you know, even my eight-year-old will eat it. And you know, it feels like a sort of moment of triumph. I think if we can make our meals those kind of daily moments of triumph, then, you know, in a sort of world that is ever-changing, I think it's a really, really important thing. And so that felt like an easy win to me, a recipe that sort of becomes a friend, mm-hmm. a recipe that is easy and quick enough for you to commit it to memory. Because mm-hmm. really, whilst I love people getting my book out, you know, and cooking from it, I want these recipes to become things that are kind of part of their cooking fabric and things that they begin to know by heart and not have to come back to all the time, because they're the recipes I cook myself at home, the ones that are kind of etched on my memory and the ones I know everyone around the table will eat. I sort of designed this book, I guess, around what I call, hopefully not too precociously, a capsule pantry. So you know the idea of a capsule wardrobe, which we're all sort of like, you know, I fantasize about having just one perfect pair of trousers, one jumper, one shirt. And I think in the kitchen, we can sort of be persuaded to buy all of these things, like a million spices, like, you know, this olive oil, that vinegar. But actually, I think if you have a really solid selection of a few things, then you can always make great tasting food. And you can also then still travel within your kitchen to lots of different cuisines and lots of different flavors. And so this is my capsule pantry, basically.
Okay.
These are the 12 things that I cook with all the time, and these are kind of my secrets to making food taste unreasonably delicious in a very short amount of time.
I love this. Unreasonable amounts of flavour given the amount of work you put
exactly.
into it.
Exactly, and that's what I always want a recipe to be. I want someone to think, this was actually really easy. I didn't have to go to four shops. I could get everything from one place. You know, there were just a few ingredients. It took me 25 minutes and everyone's thrilled. I feel like it's those moments that we need to focus on.
You mentioned your eight-year-old, now eight-year-old, but you say in the introduction to the book that after he was born, you actually suffered from postnatal depression.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
what it did was it made food and cooking, which of course was your life, suddenly very stressful, quite scary, and didn't come naturally anymore.
No.
How did that affect you coming out of that sort of depression, and how did it affect your
attitude? It was a really strange time, and I was really lucky to have, you know, amazing support around me, and a lovely husband and family, and you know, it was a really strange time for me, because I'm not someone who's ever experienced sort of real, you know, we all have our ups and downs, but no kind of serious lows or serious mental health situations. So for me, it was something completely new and I couldn't recognise what it was initially. But I think it sort of took me out of myself, all the things and all the rhythms that I felt like I knew, like, you know, cooking, you know, that is my beating heart, really. I think I was questioning myself so much and sort of overthinking everything, that cooking just didn't come easily anymore. And so I think once I sort of came out of that period and the fog lifted, I think I almost had to sort of re-teach myself to cook, and re-teach myself that confidence in the kitchen. And of course then I had a really little kid around as well. So, you know, time was much shorter.
Yeah.
And so I think the sort of recipes that perhaps 10 years ago I would have thought, oh, fantastic, I'm going to spend half a day making this, or I'm going to get this far-fangled ingredient, or, you know, I'm going to use 17 spices. That just doesn't work anymore. You know, I feel like I really want any time that people spend in the kitchen with me or with one of my recipes, I want every second to count. You know, I don't want, you know, I want there to be a great choreography to the recipe, so you're not sort of, you know, putting something on to boil and then standing back for half an hour. You know, you're using, if that's boiling for half an hour, you're using that half an hour to make a zippy little dressing, or you're chopping something fresh and crispy to go on top. So it did really change how I think about recipe writing, I think, and the kind of what I expect from people, because I think I kind of, in that reteaching that happened at that time, I think I really kind of had a newfound kind of like connection and actual, you know, sympathy for people who are learning to cook, who don't have this great big catalogue of recipes in their head that I have. And actually, you know, I just wanted things to be as simple, as easy, as joyful as they could be.
And also, you mentioned in the intro that this book itself was written, there was that incredible heat wave that we had a couple of years ago. But you had just had a second child, so you are dealing with two children.
Yeah.
Blistering heat. You do not want to be spending hours in the kitchen cooking. So as you say, it's about sort of stealing those moments that you can.
Absolutely.
To make food, but not compromising on the flavour.
Well, I actually wrote most of this book while I was very pregnant during that heat wave, and then I had my son in the November, and then, you know, I did lots of the sort of we did all the photos, and I did lots of the editing when he was really little. So yes, it's, you know, it really pulled focus. I mean, there's that old adage, isn't there, that if you want, you know, something done, ask a busy person. And I think it, you know, it was a great big old juggle, but it meant that there was no messing around. You know, any of the recipes in this book, I didn't feel like I had the energy to cook on a Tuesday or Wednesday night, just didn't make it in. And so it was quite a good kind of, you know, it was quite a good barrier to have for myself. Because, you know, if you're not juggling children, you might be juggling other people that you care for. You might have elderly parents. You might have other people that are dependent on you. You might, you know, have an insanely busy job, which so many people do. You might be traveling and commuting a really long way. And so it's not just kids. I think there's so many different pressures on us these days. And that window of time, I think in the sort of 20 years, it's crazy to think that I've been cooking for 20 years, but I have been, you know, the amount of time that we spend cooking has gone like this and been shortened and shortened and shortened. But what we expect from food because of social media and because of, you know, this foodie culture that has developed, you know, what we expect from our food is far greater. You know, you can't have people around for a, you know, tomato pasta and put a bit of fresh basil on top anymore, can you? You know, so I think it's, we've had these two things, this kind of shortening of cooking time and then this great widening of, you know, flavors and expectation. And so these recipes, I hope, are where those two things meet.
Love it. This is that was a very neat encapsulation of what the book is about. Now, as I said, as I was flicking through it, thinking, what could we make together? It was really hard because I wanted to eat everything. But I've picked a recipe which actually has ingredients, many of which are your hero ingredients. So, as you said, there's 12 simple, often store cupboard things here which can transform cooking. And actually, I think 6 of the 9 ingredients here all have their own chapter in the book. So we can talk a little bit about why they have earned their place in the book. We're going to be making tomatoes with whipped tahini.
It's right here. Yep, tomatoes with whipped tahini.
Which comes from the tahini chapter.
It does. This is a tahini chapter.
So let's start with tahini as an ingredient. Why
do you love it? By the way, also, can we just take a moment
for
these?
We can certainly take a moment for the end papers.
I mean, I want that. I want that as wallpaper somewhere in my house. So tahini as an ingredient. So obviously it was really hard to whittle it down to 12 because there are just so many amazing things to eat, aren't there? But I felt like these are the ones that I lean on the most. And tahini to me is, it's kind of an unmatchable creaminess. And it really fills, you know, as well in this book, I talk about flavor and I talk about, you know, how to build flavor. And I hope that, you know, as well as the recipes, people kind of immerse themselves a bit in those pages. But I think what tahini has that nothing else has is it has that tiny, subtle bitter note. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes that is something that's really, really missed in cooking. So it has a sweetness, it has a creaminess, it has a almost kind of umami, and it also has a bitterness. So I think lots of the ingredients that I've chosen in the book seem to have, you know, a number mm-hmm. of those kind of tastes or flavours, the salt, the sweet, the sour, the umami, the bitter. So instead of getting kind of one flavour profile, well, vinegar, for instance, is more one-dimensional in terms of its acidity, but you do get sweetness too. Mm. You get kind of a lot of bang for your buck. You get a whole rounded amount of flavours. And that's why I love tahini. Shall we get cooking?
Let's get cooking.
What do you think?
I'm here to be a very willing sous chef, but I may be more assistance by simply staying out of the way.
Well,
no,
definitely. You know what would be amazing?
Yep.
We're going to have some parsley in a bit. So if you would be up for maybe just picking some parsley into there.
Yep.
I don't want to insult your
picking
ability.
Picking parsley.
I'm sure you're good for much more than picking parsley, Will. But you know, let's start there.
How much would you like, roughly? Like a handful,
a good handful. So we've got some lovely tomatoes here, and I'm actually just chopping them up, and then I'm going to put them into a colander. And this is what I do with pretty much any fresh tomato before I eat it. So I'm going to chop them up, salt them, and put vinegar on. So you're basically seasoning the tomato, starting the story.
Right.
Seasoning the tomato kind of all the way through.
People will be very used to, obviously, when you go to buy tomatoes from a supermarket, you can tend to end up with, let's be honest, tomatoes that don't really taste very much because they've been picked before they're ripe.
Yeah.
And then I think they add a chemical, don't they, to it whilst they sit
sometimes,
there somewhere and they tend to ripen up like that.
Yep.
Is there a secret to buying tomatoes that are actually going to deliver on flavour other than growing your own?
Well, yes, I would say buy tomatoes when they're in season if you can. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're thinking about the warmer months here in the UK, but also, you know, we're in Europe, so we have amazing tomatoes from Spain and Italy and Portugal that come in a bit earlier. Also, there is this wonderful new sort of, I don't think it's new actually, but it's new to me, phenomenon of a winter tomato. So in some greengrocers and online, you can actually get these things called winter tomatoes, and they're tomatoes that are grown mostly in Spain and Italy, kind of, a lot of them are grown by the sea. So they have sort of a real lovely saltiness from the kind of sea air. But they're tomatoes that kind of ripen in December, January and February.
Wow.
And they are, you know, some of the varieties, they're called Camone, I think, Raff, Mirinda. They're completely different in flavour from the kind of juicy, ripe tomatoes you get in the summer. They're a bit, their flesh is a bit firmer, they're a bit saltier, I think they're a bit more savoury, and they're amazing ones to look out for in the winter months if you want to make a tomato salad. I think if you're sort of shopping in a supermarket, then, you know, I think actually cherry tomatoes are usually pretty reliable in their sweetness. And, you know, we're really lucky in the UK. I mean, look at the inside of that one.
Look at that.
How amazing. We're pretty lucky in the UK because we do have the amazing tomatoes from the Isle of Wight. Mm-hmm. And they're grown in, you know, in polytunnels down there in the winter. So we do have, you know, some British grown tomatoes for most of the year.
The colours that you've, I mean, there's already a rainbow of colours in this bowl. And I remember the first time I went to a French supermarket and they had this sort of huge selection of tomatoes, lots of different colours. There's a lot of talk about how eating a rainbow of foods can actually have huge health benefits. Would you subscribe
Absolutely.
To that?
Big time, yeah. I am not one necessarily to go in for sort of nutrition or wellness or that kind of advice, but So the one thing I do sort of adhere to is trying to eat the rainbow, essentially.
Yeah.
And I mean that kind of in terms of the fruit and veg I eat, but also in terms of kind of the grains and the spices. I feel like if you vary your diet, each of these colours represents different nutrients.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think if we spread the net as wide as possible, then I think nutritionally, you're going to kind of get what you need without really having to think about it too much. You know, centering your diet around fruit and veg, first of all, is always going to be a good idea, isn't it? For the planet, for our, you know, for how we feel, and mm-hmm. also for, you know, for nutrition as well. So yeah, you want to add about, it's quite a lot of salt here, but I would say about a teaspoon of salt. And I'm using flaky salt here. My favourite salt is one made up in Wales, actually in the island my husband is from, Anglesey. Which is kind of cheesy, but you know.
Other salts are available.
Other salts are available.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say a flaky salt is best.
And people often talk about a pinch of salt, and I think you say this in the book, that a pinch isn't literally what you can pinch between thumb and forefinger.
Exactly.
It's more like a three finger, like yeah. It's a good, healthy.
Yeah, so I would say, you know, a pinch is more like this.
Yeah.
You know, that to me is a generous pinch of salt.
Gotcha.
And I think some people will do this and then have the tiniest bit and wonder why their food is not tasting great.
Yeah.
But I think the key thing with seasoning, and there's a whole section on seasoning in this book, because I really think that's one of the key things that's maybe different from home cooking to mm-hmm. cooking in restaurants. And people can't believe when they go to a restaurant like how delicious this tomato salad is. And
yeah.
you know, one of the reasons for that will probably be because the tomato is in season and being used at its peak. But another reason will usually be because the seasoning is great. So I'm going to do about a tablespoonful. This is a massive tablespoon, so I might not go for the whole thing, of red wine vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
And I always think it's useful to have this in a colander above a bowl, and then you can catch all the juices underneath, because we're yep. actually going to use some of those later mm-hmm. in our dressing. And this is red wine vinegar. There's a whole chapter in the book on vinegar as well,
yep.
because I think, as well as sort of seasoning, I think the most obvious thing often missing from food is acidity.
Okay.
And again, I think that's something chefs in restaurants are always really, really good at using, adding that squeeze of lemon, that bit of lime,
yeah.
That vinegar. And at home, I guess maybe we don't think, you know, you might put salt and pepper on your tomatoes, but you might not put
yeah.
vinegar. And so I think that is one of the most, one of the quickest ways, I think, of kind of rounding out a dish. So if you think about a dal,
mm-hmm.
You've made it taste good, but there's something missing. A big squeeze of lemon at the
yeah.
end is always going to kind of lift it, brighten it. And so, I think there's some really smart ways of kind of cooking with vinegar mm-hmm. as well. There's an apple pie in the book, which is where the apples are kind of macerated in vinegar first. So there's all these surprising ways of using these quite kind of, you know, normal ingredients. And also the world of vinegar is immense. I feel like we've got, you know, we've sort of touched on a little bit with olive oil, like
yeah.
how many amazing olive oils are out there. And I think people are open to the fact that there's buttery, there's peppery, there's all these different extra virgin, but vinegar is a whole incredible world in itself, because each wine has its vinegar.
Yeah.
You know, there's Muscatel vinegar,
taste, yeah.
there's not just red and white, but you know, there's Rioja vinegar, there's sherry vinegar, there's all these things that have these amazing profiles. And if you're someone that sort of geeks out on ingredients like I do, then
yeah.
you know, it's an amazing world to explore. If you're not, then just get yourself a bottle of red wine vinegar and splash that.
I do want to give a shout out as well. You mentioned lemons. Lemons
yeah.
don't feature in this recipe, but they are the first chapter in the book.
Yeah.
And first of all, it's just an amazing chapter because there's such variety there.
But
as you say, just having lemons in your kitchen, not only does it just look nice to have a bowl of lemons
yeah.
in your kitchen, but as you say, when you feel like there's something missing, it is often as simple as a squeeze of lemon juice at the
yeah.
very end of cooking. I've used it to invigorate so many different things.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of my favourite things in the book, actually, is the stuff about lemon, because it's so versatile.
Thank you. It is. It's definitely my favourite ingredient. If I had to...
I was going to ask you if
yeah.
you had to pick one.
Yeah, if I had to pick one, it would be a lemon, yeah.
There you go.
I think all my friends just think I'm hilarious because they come into my house and I have this sort of like groaning bowl of lemons. They're like, you cannot actually get through those. I'm like, watch me.
What? Yeah.
So lemon goes on everything in our house. And I think it's just such an uplifting flavour. But of course, if... you know, having fresh lemons around is not what you do. There's
yeah.
lots of other acids, and vinegar is a great kind of a great way of adding that acidity as well. So,
garlic.
Yeah,
another hero ingredient.
Yeah, another hero ingredient. Well, when I was sort of coming up with this kind of, I guess, capsule pantry
yeah.
for the book, I didn't initially have kind of onions and garlic in there. But then when I sort of started really thinking about how I build most of the dishes that I cook, I was like, well, I can't miss them out.
Yeah.
And also I think they're quite often kind of, I mean, garlic more is seen, you taste in its own right and it is a bit of a shining star. But onions quite often are always the kind of supporting act.
Yeah.
They're always the kind of, you know, they're always the background guy. And I wanted to kind of put them both front and center. And also everyone has a bulb of garlic.
Yeah.
It's cheap as chips. You know, there are so few houses you go into that don't have a bulb of garlic. And I was really keen in this book to, whilst we have some, you know, things like tahini or miso that, you know, maybe not everyone has in all the time. You're always going to have garlic. You're always going to have a tin of tomatoes. You're always going to have some onions. But yeah, the garlic, chapter in this book uses garlic in so many different ways, because I think quite a lot of us will chop it up and, you know, either, you know, mix it into a dip or perhaps fry it off. But when I was a young chef, one of the things we used to do is very, very finely slice garlic and then fry it off into these little kind of delicate garlic crisps. And we'd put those on top of things. And so one of the things I find fascinating is how many flavors and textures you can get out of one ingredient. And if you think about the price of a clove of garlic, I don't know how much that is, but maybe 5p.
Yeah.
And to be able to get this really amazing flavor and texture out of something that is, you know, in everyone's kitchens is brilliant. There's a soup in the garlic chapter as well, which is lots of finely sliced kind of fried garlic, chili, pickled ginger, you know, that you use for sushi. And then I make a very simple and really quick broth with this fried garlic and pickled ginger. And it's what I crave now whenever I'm ill. It's kind of that, one of those really, really kind of brightening, cheering soups. Obviously, I'm vegetarian, so I don't have chicken soup, but it feels like that.
Okay.
Feels like my equivalent of chicken soup. Right, so we're going to get on with the tahini now.
Yep.
And we're going to whip this tahini. So a few things are going to go into the blender. We've got the tahini here. Now, we did talk a bit about tahini. There are obviously, as with any ingredient, not all tahinis are equal. Sometimes you get really kind of dense ones. Sometimes you get quite liquidy ones.
Yeah.
You have two types, one where the seeds are hulled, so they don't have their little shells, and then one where they're unhulled. And the one I use the most is this, the unhulled one, because it's nice and creamy.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, I think, you know, this is a Lebanese tahini, which is always good. I mean, there's great tahinis from kind of all over the world. But, you know, to me, the most reliable ones seem to come in these plastic tahini-coloured pots and come from corner shops rather than being the ones that you buy in the supermarket. So we want about 150 grams of tahini in here, which I'm obviously measuring really, really precisely. Mm-hmm. The idea for this sort of, I guess, salad dish came from my friend Ed Smith, who goes under the sort of name Rocket and Squash. He used to write a blog called Rocket and Squash, and he's absolutely brilliant. His recipes are amazing. And he used to make this thing called tomato tonato.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, I had a gigantic craving for it one day. But the tonato, the sort of sauce that he makes to go with it, has tuna in. And I was trying to think of how. But it's this very, I don't eat it anymore, but my memories of it are this very silky, very lovely sauce. And so I was trying to sort of create that with tahini. And whipping it like this, I just think is really, really fun. So in there goes the tahini. We've got two cloves of garlic. I mean, those are real whoppers, so I might just do one and a half to not blow anyone's head off. Then we need some, actually just going to check exactly how much here.
So you've got a book there that you can refer to.
I've got a book there,
and
actually,
whilst you're doing that, you do point out that another one of the ways that you've tried to simplify things is that you include the measurements in the method. So often when you're looking at a recipe, you'll have all the measurements of your ingredients, and then when you come to the method, it doesn't specify how much you're supposed to be using of that thing, which is very frustrating.
Exactly.
But you have made it as simple as possible.
I have. I've really geeked out on the recipe the way the method is written and how clear it is on the page. So basically, hopefully no one will even notice because it's really, really easy to read. But my frustration has always been reading a recipe. You get halfway down, you're like, oh yeah, add the flour. How much flour? Okay, back to the ingredients list. Okay, 200 grams of flour. Back to the, where was I?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I wasn't there. That, not that flour, that flour. That, and so for me, as someone, because I'm sort of mildly dyslexic, for me, putting those into the method has been a complete game changer, and I find it much, much easier. So, in here, we've got our tahini, our garlic, our red wine vinegar, our Dijon mustard, and then we need about 100 mils of water. So I'm just going to grab a little bit of water. We want it to be icy, icy cold.
Icy, icy cold. You do say in your method that it will seize up when you're whipping it up together. It's going to seize, because it's tahini. It's basically edible concrete.
Yeah.
But it will then loosen up.
It will then loosen again,
So don't lose faith.
Yeah, tahini has a really funny texture. It's a bit like, you know, when you mix corn flour into water, you're not quite sure how much, you're not quite sure.
It's a non-Newtonian fluid.
Yeah, exactly. You're just like, is this from this planet? I'm not sure. Tahini is the same, but trust me. So we've got some ice cold water.
Yep.
And we want about 100 mils, which will be the same as 100 grams. And just because I'm doing this, I'm such a fly by the seat of my pants cook usually. But because we're doing this together, I really want it to work.
Okay.
So I'm just going to add, there we go.
Perfect.
110 will.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. So yeah, we need about 100 mils, and it's important that it's cold because I think that helps the tahini kind of whip up. So it's going to whack on here. It looks deeply unappetizing at the moment, but I promise you it will look great. While that's going, we can do a bit of our... We're basically going to make a little sort of parsley salsa, I would say.
Yeah.
To go on top. If you're familiar with salsa verde,
salsa
it's not
verde.
Kind of a million miles away from something like that.
Yeah.
That could be the sound of the tahini seizing.
Okay.
Can you hear it?
So, it's a cry for help.
Yeah, it's a cry for help.
Which we're going to ignore.
Yeah, but don't worry. You have to trust it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever made butter. Have you ever made butter?
I haven't, but TikTok is filled with
people. Where you whip it and whip it and whip it, and you think nothing's happening, and then it separates, and then you think that it's all gone absolutely wrong. But actually, it's exactly what you're looking for. So it's kind of what's happening with the tahini here. It's going to seize a bit, and then it needs to kind of... go through that phase. It's a bit like a toddler having a tantrum. It needs to get it all out, and then it will whip up into the most pillowy, delightful texture. So we're just going to use not the whole red onion here, just probably about a quarter of it.
Yep.
If you had a shallot at home as well, you could absolutely use a shallot.
So you're looking for a sweeter onion,
Yeah. And there are some quite sweet white onions now. You can buy these ones called Roscoff onions that are really sweet.
Mm.
I would say the key thing is here to not, for me anyway, because I'm not a lover of really, really chunky raw onion, is to kind of get your onion reasonably small.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you're not a sort of fancy chopper, all you need to do is get your knife, and I think everyone thinks they have to sort of chop it really finely immediately, but you know, if you're not happy with how finely you've chopped something, you can always just run your knife through it a couple more times. So we're going to add that to our parsley,
mm-hmm.
and then we're going to add a bit of salt. I'm going to actually add that on top of the onion because the salt is kind of going to break down the rawness of the onion, and then I'm also just going to swig a little bit of red wine vinegar onto the onion too. And this isn't strictly in the recipe, but we're freestyling here, aren't we? I'm just going to, so that is basically very quickly pickling the onion.
Yep.
And because, as I said, I'm not a lover of completely raw onion, I do that you know, any salad I'm making, I'll put a little bit of salt, a little bit of vinegar on the onion before it goes into anything. Now, this is our other ingredient, olive oil. And I think we're sort of, especially in the UK, we're quite conditioned to think of olive oil as something that you cook with, or, you know, you don't use in great quantities. And obviously you can see here, I'm adding a fair bit of olive oil.
Yeah.
But I think especially in the kind of cooking I do, which is sort of vegetable led, vegetarian cooking, you know, you're not getting lots of fats from other things. You might get a bit of fat from cheese or some yogurt or some dairy. So actually I use quite a lot of olive oil to bring that richness, to bring that fat, to bring things together. So our tahini is hopefully looking good. Yeah, so see, that's really kind of gone incredibly creamy. Smells amazing. This is the sort of creaminess, this is the bitterness, this is the richness of this dish. And yeah, you can smell the garlic.
Smells good.
Yeah, that's delicious. So, One extra thing we are going to do, so we've got our red onion in here, we've got our parsley, we've got a bit of olive oil. And remember I talked about having the colander over the bowl to catch the juices. And that's because these juices are, they're absolutely delicious. They're kind of highly seasoned tomato juices. So you might not want to add kind of the whole thing, but adding a little bit of this to our kind of salsa is just going to add some depth, because it's got the vinegar in there, it's got those lovely juices from the tomatoes, it's got the salt and pepper. So we're just going to add that in, and that's just going to kind of round out that, and we're kind of not wasting anything. I mean, there's still a tablespoonful of tomato juice in there, but I hope you'll let me off. So we can put it all together.
Yep.
So the way I like, you know, you can do this however you like, but the way I kind of like to do this is to kind of make a little bed for my tomatoes. Mm-hmm. So kind of get all of my tahini, or as much as I can get out of the jug. Love these blenders.
Yeah.
We could be doing a blender advert today, couldn't we?
This is not our first blender, and it is not the easiest to...
Yeah, exactly. You may have noticed a blender switch, guys.
There has been, yeah.
Yeah, if you did.
Join us on episode 2.
Yeah, exactly.
To find out what happened with the first blender.
Exactly. Give yourself an enormous pat on the back if you notice that blender change. So we've got our amazing kind of tahini there, and you can see how that is like thick and lustrous and delicious. And it's got that bitterness, it's got that creaminess, it's got that... richness. And then on top we're gonna sort of pile on our lovely tomatoes, which are, I have to say, unbelievable colours, aren't they?
Yeah, incredible colours. And you can actually smell, there is a fantastic smell coming off those tomatoes, which is all to do with that, the fact that they have been
in that vinegar
seasoned.
Yeah, it seems like not very much, but I think just by whipping that tahini, creating that creaminess, creating that slightly different and unexpected texture. And obviously that's got that punchy garlic in there.
Yeah.
You know, this becomes something, I'd be happy to eat this with some flatbreads, maybe, you know, some feta kind of clanked up and crumbled up next to it. So we are going to, at this point, add, I think, the capers next.
Yep. Capers, another hero ingredient. I have their own.
Yep. Another hero ingredient. I'm just going to grab a little spoon for them.
Just before we started, you were saying that caper brine is something that you have started to use increasingly in cooking. So rather than it just being the juice that it's stored in.
Absolutely.
So why is that? Because it's got that sort of capery flavour, but also the vinegar and the sort of saltiness of the brine.
Absolutely. I think it's one... I think capers, along with lemons, are probably my two most used ingredients. Are just that kind of punchy, salty acidity. I just cannot get enough of. And I think as a vegetarian, I don't eat anchovies.
Yep.
And when I haven't always been vegetarian, so I used to cook with anchovies, and I used to love that kind of rounded, depth and umami that they used to bring, especially to a pasta sauce or something. And so I do miss them, but I don't want to eat them. And actually for me, sort of capers stand in there. So as well as kind of like as a punchy little poppy, you know, whole caper, I use the brine, as we were saying, as an ingredient. So there's a recipe in the book for a caper brine margarita, which I implore you to make.
Oh my gosh.
It is absolutely delicious. I should have made it for you today. What was I thinking?
I don't know.
There's another recipe that uses the caper brine to put on top of a focaccia. So the brine soaks in and perfectly seasons the dough, and then it kind of, you know, crisps up and cooks, and then you put a bit more brine over the top at the end. And I actually think this brine, you know, it's a free ingredient.
Yeah.
We don't want to throw it away. So it's great in dressings. Obviously, some capers come just salted, so then you don't get the brine. But if you have a jar of it, it's just like, you know, the brine from a pickle, for instance. Absolutely delicious in a dressing. So, yeah, capers, big fan. So to finish off, we're just going to pop a little bit of this lovely sort of parsley, red onion, and that can just sit. That's what I love to kind of like. I love food that has like pools, you know, when you have a pool and then you have a little pool of olive oil around the edge and you just know that there's going to be some good stuff in there. I love a bit of dressing. I love a bit of kind of, you scoop up and then there's all this extra delicious kind of layer underneath that you didn't even know was there.
Yeah.
So yeah.
There you go. So it's really important to point out that in terms of fresh ingredients, there are the tomatoes. So for anybody who's struggling to find nice tomatoes, when you do find them, it's about bringing them home and then making something like this one so they really sing.
Because
a bit of onion and a bit of garlic and the parsley, but everything else is from a jar or a bottle that you can have in the cupboard.
Absolutely.
Ready for
and I think the great thing about these, you know, the tomatoes and the parsley, obviously they're sort of fresh ingredients, but, you know, the onions and the garlic, they'll sit around for weeks and weeks and weeks, don't they? So, you know, this is the kind of thing. And I can imagine, you know, outside of tomato season, you could do this exact same dish. You could have, you know, a charred courgette. You could have some wedges of butternut squash that you've roasted in the oven. You could have, even imagine like delicious, delicious roast potatoes with this tahini underneath and then this lovely vinegary thing on the top. And then the capers studded around. So I love this with tomatoes. But I think once you have these things that work and are recipes that you love or things that your family like, you don't always have to be tied into doing it one way. You know, as the seasons change, you can sort of take that principle and, you know, make it with the things that are good at that time. So we should probably try some, shouldn't we?
We should. It would be rude. It would be rude not to. This looks and smells fantastic already. Wow. I haven't even put it in my mouth yet.
Wow. It is a simple thing, but a simple thing hopefully done well and with, you know, lots of dimensions of flavour.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I'm going in.
The creaminess against the freshness of the tomato is really something, isn't it?
Also, so tahini is one of those things. I did a lovely bit of filming with Alexina Allentol, and her book Bitter talks about all these bitter ingredients, including tahini. And we just had a mouthful of tahini, and the interview was pretty much over then because we couldn't actually speak after that. Because it's so cloying and it's so claggy. But this is not. This is smooth and creamy. And it's almost, I mean, of course, a lot of people know tahini from hummus, where it is far more sort of edible than on its own. But here it's even smoother, even
easier. Well, I think that's the great thing about sort of whipping it in this way, is you add a bit of water so it kind of mellows. It mellows that bitter flavour a bit, but then you have the garlic in there, you have a bit of vinegar, so it kind of seasons it into a lovely dressing. So, yeah. Take this home.
Oh man.
Get a couple of flatbreads from the corner shop on the way.
That's not going to make it home. Absolutely delicious. And I can't thank you enough. It's, as I say, to talk about why some of these ingredients are worthy of their own chapters in this book. And anybody who picks it up will see the very different things that you're able to do with an onion, for example, or garlic. We have scratched the surface and broken a couple of blenders. Thank you so much for taking the time to tell me a bit more.
Well, I think the blenders might have been broken in the first place, but...
we'll let the insurance deal with that.
Yeah, exactly. But No, it's been a joy to have you. It's been a joy to have you in the kitchen. It's been really fun. Come back for a Caper Brine margarita.
That's, I'm taking you up on that.
It's a deal. It's a deal.